I did they would let my property alone. He could easily take some horses, he said, the horses of the men who had stolen knives and tomahawks, but since he did not know who the thieves were, he would rather lose the property altogether than take the horse of an innocent person. The Indians hung their heads and said nothing. That afternoon, Lewis set off, with 9 horses carrying baggage, and 1 being ridden by Private William Bratton, who had a severe back condition and could not walk. Lewis was in a better mood. He always was happiest when proceeding, and looking forward to getting out of the Chinookan country and back in the land of the Nez Perce, where he expected that the natives will treat us with much more hospitality than those we are now with. But the next morning, April 22nd, local Chinookans stole a saddle and robe. Lewis's blood rose past a danger point. He swore he would either get the stolen goods back or burn their houses. They have vexed me in such a manner by such repeated acts of villainy that I am quite disposed to treat them with every severity. Their defenseless state pleads forgiveness so far as respects their lives. He ordered a thorough search of the village and marched there himself, resolved to burn the place down if he didn't get the saddle and robe back. That was the closest Lewis came to applying the principle of collective guilt. Fortunately, the men found the stolen goods hidden in a corner of one of the houses before Lewis reached the village. He had been wonderfully lucky. Had those goods not been recovered, he might have given the order to put the houses to the torch. The resulting conflagration would have been a gross overreaction, unpardonably unjust, and a permanent blot on his honor. It would have turned every Chinookan village on the lower Columbia against the Americans, and thus made impossible the fulfillment of the plan Lewis was developing for a transcontinental, American-run trading empire. He had a lot at stake, but he had been ready to allow his anger to override his judgment. To modern eyes, this looks suspiciously like racism. Just as Lewis's resolve to burn down the village raises images of the U.S. Army in the Indian Wars and in Vietnam. But if one means by racism a blind prejudice toward Native Americans, based on false but fully believed stereotypes, Lewis was no racist. When he talked about Indian nations, he meant the word just as he applied it to European peoples. He was keenly aware of differences between tribes, a subject he wrote about at length and with insight. He liked some Indians, admired others extravagantly, pitied some, despised a few. His response to Native Americans was based on what he saw and was completely different from his response to African Americans. With regard to blacks, he made no distinctions between them, made no study of them, had no thought that they could be of benefit to America in any capacity other than slave labor. But despite his cold-blooded words and resolutions, and his hatred of the Chinooks, what stands out about his journey up the lower Columbia in the spring of 1806 is that he got through it without ever once ordering a man to put a torch to an Indian home, and no man ever fired a rifle at a native. He had, however, 4 times lost his temper and twice threatened to kill. His behavior was erratic and threatening to the future of the expedition. There would be other tribes to encounter, other forms of provocation. Lewis would be tested on his self-control, not his strongest character trait. On April 24th, the expedition marched overland. "Most of the party complain of the soreness of their feet and legs this evening," Lewis recorded. "My left ankle gives me much pain." A cold water foot bath helped. By the 27th, the party reached the country of Chief Yellept and the Walla Wallas, relatives of the Nez Perce. The chief rode up with 6 men and was delighted to see the white men, as they were to see him. Yellept was chief of a village of some 15 lodges, with perhaps 150 men, and many horses. It was currently set up about 12 miles below the junction of the Columbia and the Snake on the north bank. The captains had promised Yellept the previous October that they would stay a day or two with him on the return journey. He now invited the captains to bring the expedition to his village, where he promised food and horses. A 3-day visit ensued. Yellept set an example for his people by personally bringing wood and fish to the white men. On the second morning, he presented Clark with a very elegant white horse, an act of generosity that lost some of its luster when Yellept indicated he would like a kettle in return. "No kettle," the captain said. "Then whatever they thought proper," Yellept replied. Clark gave him his sword plus 100 balls and powder. Yellept was satisfied. What Yellept did genuinely give away was information. For the first time since they had left the Shoshones, the captains had an interpretive route that allowed them to go beyond the sign language. There was a captive Shoshone woman with the Walla Wallas who could speak to Sacagawea, who could pass it on to Charbonneau, who could communicate with Driard or Labiche, who, finally, could speak to the captains in English. "We conversed with them for several hours," Lewis wrote, "and fully satisfied all their inquiries with respect to ourselves and the objects of our pursuit." In return, Yalup told Lewis of a shortcut to the western end of the Lolo Trail. That evening, Yalup's relatives and neighbors, the Yakimaws, came in at his invitation to see the white men and have a party. There were about 100 men and a few women. Together with the Walla Wallas, they surrounded the white men and waited patiently to see them dance. Crouzat brought out the fiddle, and for an hour the men danced, to the delight of the Indians. Then the Indians, some 550 men, women, and children, sung and danced at the same time. Most of them stood in the same place and merely jumped up to the time of their music. But the bravest men went into the center of the circle and danced in a circular manner sidewise. To the Indians' gratification, some of the white men joined in the dance. This was much different from evenings on the Lower Columbia. On the morning of April 29th, two inferior chiefs presented each of the captains with a horse. The gift was welcome, but the return present was expensive. Lewis wrote, "We gave them sundry articles and, among others, one of my case pistols and several hundred rounds of ammunition." That pistol was a highest quality, custom-made weapon, a so-called dueling pistol, kept in a case with accessories, and it was Lewis's personal property, not government issue. The following day, "We took leave of these friendly, honest people, the Walla Wallas, and departed at 11 a.m. The shortcut Yalup told them about took them across the base of the northern bend of the Snake, saving some 80 miles. Thanks to the Walla Wallas, the party had 23 horses, most of them excellent young horses, but much the greater portion of them have sore backs. These Indians are cruel horse masters. They ride hard, and their saddles are so ill constructed. Regardless of this, they ride them when the backs of those poor animals are in a horrid condition." The second night out, three teenage Walla Walla boys rode into camp. They were returning a steel trap that had been negligently left behind. Lewis called this an act of integrity rarely witnessed among Indians, without adding that it was also rare among whites, but he praised the Walla Wallas for returning knives carelessly lost by the men. Lewis paid a final tribute to the Walla Wallas. "I think we can justly affirm to the honor of these people that they are the most hospitable, honest, and sincere people that we have met within our voyage." The march the next 2 days was god-awful. The weather was miserable. Rain, hail, and snow with high winds. At dinner on May 3rd, the captains divided the last of the dried meat and the balance of the dogs. "We made but a scant supper and had not anything for tomorrow." Their luck held. The next day, the party encountered a band of roving Nez Perce, led by Chief Titoharsky, the man who had helped Twisted Hair as a guide the previous autumn. He offered to take them to Twisted Hair's village and sold them some roots and fuel. They set off together in the morning. When they reached a village, they tried to purchase provisions without much success. But they discovered that Captain Clark had quite a reputation with these natives as a doctor. It seemed that the previous fall, Clark had washed and then rubbed some liniment on an old Indian man's sore knee and thigh, accompanying the doctoring with what Clark called much ceremony. The man had not walked for months, but recovered with Clark's therapy. "Since then," Lewis wrote, "this band has never ceased to extol the virtues of our medicines." Together with the effectiveness of the eye water, the Nez Perce had an exalted opinion of our medicine. My friend Captain C is their favorite physician and has already received many applications. The captains could pay for their keep by establishing a hospital. Lewis was a bit disturbed at thus fooling the Indians. He doubted there was much that could be done for most of the complaints, and he was embarrassed to be practicing psychosomatic medicine. He rationalized his way to a justification. "In our present situation, I think it pardonable to continue this deception, for they will not give us any provision without compensation. We take care to give them no article which can possibly injure them." In fact, Clark did much good for the Nez Perce. The Indians kept coming because they were benefiting from his therapy. There was no need for Lewis to feel embarrassment. The Indians paid for the therapy with roots and dogs. The dogs were another source of potential embarrassment. The Nez Perce ate horse meat only to ward off starvation and never ate dog. On May 3rd, Lewis related a dog meat anecdote in a piece of concise storytelling. While at dinner, an Indian fellow very impertinently threw a poor, half-starved puppy nearly into my plate by way of derision for our eating dogs and laughed very heartily at his own impertinence. I was so provoked at his insolence that I caught the puppy and threw it with great violence at him and struck him in the breast and face, seized my tomahawk, and showed him by signs if he repeated his insolence, I would tomahawk him. The fellow withdrew, apparently much mortified, and I continued my repast on dog without further molestation. Generally, relations with the Nez Perce were excellent. On May 7th, an Indian rode in with two canisters of powder. His dog had dug them up at the cache the expedition had made in October. The captains rewarded his honesty with a piece of fire-making steel. That day, the Bitterroot Mountains came into view. They were perfectly covered with snow. The Nez Perce gave the captains unfortunate news. The winter snows had been heavy, the snow was yet deep in the mountains, so no passage was possible until early June at best. "To men confined to a diet of horse beef and roots," Lewis wrote, "and who are as anxious as we are to return to the fat plains of the Missouri and thence to our native homes, this was unwelcome intelligence." The party hated to be stopped. Every day, other than those in winter camp, the men tried to make some progress. Furthermore, beyond those mountains there was tobacco, tools, kettles. On the Missouri plains there were the calves, providing unlimited quantities of tender veal, supplemented by buffalo hump and buffalo tongue, with sausage made by Charbonneau. The captains and their men had been thinking about the upcoming feast for weeks. Now they learned that they would have to stay where they were for 3 weeks, possibly longer, with nothing to eat but dried fish and roots, and when they were lucky, lean elk and deer, or horse meat, or dog. Morale sank. On the morning of May 8th, some of the men ordered out to hunt, instead lay about the camp, without our permission or knowledge. The captains found it necessary to chide them severely for their indolence and inattention. That day, the Americans chanced on Chief Cutnose with a party of six. Cutnose had been off on a raid the previous fall, but Lewis had heard of him and knew he was regarded as a greater chief than Twisted Hair. The Indians and white men rode on together, and soon encountered Twisted Hair with a half-dozen warriors. It was Twisted Hair who had agreed to keep the Americans' horses through the winter. He had been promised 2 guns and ammunition as his reward, and guided the expedition as far down the Snake Columbia as the Dalles. The captains were naturally delighted to see him, but he greeted the white men very coolly. Lewis found this as unexpected as it was unaccountable. Twisted Hair turned to Cutnose and began shouting and making angry gestures. Cutnose answered in kind. This continued for some 20 minutes. The captains had no idea what was going on, but clearly they had to break it up. They needed the friendship of both chiefs if they were to get through the next 3 weeks, and they needed their horses if they were to have any chance of getting over the mountains. They informed the chiefs that the expedition was proceeding. The Indians fell in behind, keeping a distance from each other. When the expedition made camp, the two chiefs with their little bands formed separate camps at a short distance. They all appeared to be in an ill humor. The captains called for a council. They relied on a Shoshone boy with cut nose to interpret for them, but he refused to speak. He alleged it was a quarrel between two chiefs and that he had no business with it. For the next hour, the captains could make no sense out of the violent quarrel. They were in an agony of suspense, anxious to reunite with their horses and to keep the Nez Perce as friends. The captains pleaded with the Shoshone boy, but he remained obstinately silent. The chiefs departed for their respective camps, still angry with each other. An hour later, Driard returned from hunting. The captains invited Twisted Hair for a smoke. He accepted and through Driard explained that when he had returned from the Dalles the previous fall, he had collected the expedition's horses and taken charge of them. Cutnose then returned from his war party and, according to Twisted Hair, asserted his primacy among the Nez Perce. He said Twisted Hair shouldn't have accepted the responsibility, that it was he, Cutnose, who should be in charge. Twisted Hair said he got so sick of hearing this stuff that he paid no further attention to the horses, who consequently scattered. But most of them were around, many of them with Chief Broken Arm, who lived upriver and was a chief of great eminence. The captains invited Cutnose to join the campfire. He came and told us in the presence of the Twisted Hair that he, the Twisted Hair, was a bad old man, that he wore two faces. Cutnose charged that Twisted Hair had never taken care of the horses, but had allowed his young men to ride them and misuse them, and that was the reason Cutnose and Broken Arm had forbidden him to retain responsibility for the animals. The captain said they would proceed to Broken Arm's camp in the morning and see how many horses and saddles they could collect. This was satisfactory to Twisted Hair and Cutnose, who had calmed down considerably after being allowed to tell their sides of the story. The next day, everyone moved to Broken Arm's lodge, which was some 150 feet long, built of sticks, mats, and grass. There, the expedition recovered 21 horses, about half the saddles, and some ammunition that had been cached. Lewis paid Twisted Hair 1 gun, 100 balls, and 2 pounds of powder for his services, and said the other promised gun would be delivered when the balance of the horses were brought in. The gun he gave Twisted Hair was an old, beat-up British trading musket, for which he had paid a Chinook 2 elk skins. When the captains explained their supply situation and asked if the Indians would exchange a good but lean horse of theirs for a fat young horse, with a view to slaughter the colt for food, Broken Arm said he was revolted at the idea of an exchange. His people had a great abundance of colts, however, and the white men could have as many as they wanted. He soon produced 2 fat colts and demanded nothing in return. Lewis commented that this was the only act which deserves the appellation of hospitality which we have witnessed in this quarter. Over the next couple of days, various other chiefs joined Cutnose and Twisted Hair at Broken Arm's lodge. Altogether, the Nez Perce were some 4,000 strong, living in their separate bands, and had by far the largest horse herd on the continent. These chiefs had a constituency that demanded attention. The captains seized their opportunity and held a conference of all the leading men of the Nez Perce. Lewis made a speech. It took nearly half a day for him to get his main points across because the interpretation had to pass through French, Hidatsa, and Shoshone to get to Nez Perce. The main points were peace and harmony among the natives on each side of the Rocky Mountains, the strength and power of the United States, the trading posts that were coming. The captains did not refer to the Nez Perce as their children or to Jefferson as the Indians' new father, but as James Rhonda writes, thoughts of sovereignty were not far from the Americans' minds. Beyond the American claim to lands west of the Louisiana Purchase, Lewis and Clark had other goals. One was to persuade the Nez Perce to send some guides and diplomats with the expedition to the Blackfoot country. The captain said they would make a peace between the two tribes so that the Nez Perce could come live on the Buffalo side of the Continental Divide and, not incidentally, bring all those horses with them. The captains also wanted 1, 2, or 3 chiefs to accompany them back to Washington to meet the president. The chiefs appeared highly pleased with the presentation, but said that they would have to consult among themselves before replying. After the conference, the captains held a magic show, displaying the latest in European and American technology, including a magnet, a spyglass, a compass, a watch, and sundry other articles equally novel and incomprehensible to them. Lewis shot his air gun. The Nez Perce were astonished and impressed. The chiefs then withdrew for their consultation. The next morning, May 12th, the chiefs informed the captains that they had resolved to pursue our advice. To get the power of the people behind the decision, Broken Arm held a sort of plebiscite. He made up a dish of pounded roots and soup, then gave a speech. He announced the decision to do as the Americans wished, then asked all those who were ready to abide by that decision to come forward and eat. Those who opposed would show their sentiments by not eating. There was not a dissenting voice on this great national question, Lewis wrote, but all swallowed their objections, if any they had, very cheerfully with their mush. It turned out, however, that what the Nez Perce Nation had agreed to do was far short of what the captains had asked. The chief said the people were willing to move east of the mountains, but only after the United States Army had a fort on the Missouri, where they could trade for arms and ammunition to defend themselves. As for a delegate to the Blackfeet, they rather thought not. And as for a delegate to the president, perhaps, maybe, sometime later. The Nez Perce concluded by warning the captains it was too early even to think about crossing the mountains. The captains could think of little else. "We are anxious to procure some guides to accompany us on the different routes we mean to take from Traveler's Rest," Lewis wrote. Lewis did most of the smoking and talking with the chiefs while Clark practiced medicine. Every morning his patients lined up for treatment. He used eyewash, hot rubdowns, and simples for sore eyes, scrofula, tuberculosis of the lymph glands, ulcers, rheumatism, and other ailments. One case was particularly difficult. An old chief had been suffering from paralysis for 3 years. "He was incapable of moving a single limb," Lewis reported, "but lies like a corpse in whatever position he is placed. Yet he eats heartily, digests his food perfectly, enjoys his understanding, his pulse are good, and has retained his flesh almost perfectly." Nothing Clark tried on him seemed to do any good. Among the party, Bratton was still suffering from his bad back. Sacagawea's son, Jean-Baptiste, in addition to teething, had a high fever and a swollen neck and throat. The captains gave him some tartar and sulfur and applied a poultice of boiled onions to his neck, as hot as he could stand it. The therapy did no good. A few days later, Lewis wrote that the boy was very restless last night. Its jaw and the back of its neck are much more swollen. We gave it a dose of cream of tartar and applied a fresh poultice of onions. Clark had better results with Bratton. At Private John Shields's suggestion, Clark prescribed a sweat bath for Bratton. A sweat lodge was built, stones were heated up and placed inside. Bratton went in naked with a vessel of water to sprinkle on the stones to make steam, and after 20 minutes he was taken out and plunged into cold water. Then back to the sweat lodge. Within a day, Bratton was walking, free from pain for the first time in months. Sacagawea's boy slowly recovered, but the paralyzed chief showed no improvement. Lewis regretted that he was not back in Philadelphia, where Benjamin Franklin had experimented with electricity to treat paralytic cases. "I am confident that this chief would be an excellent subject for electricity," Lewis wrote on May 27th. Instead of shock therapy, the captains decided on heat therapy. They built a sweat lodge for the chief and put him in, fortified with 30 drops of laudanum for relaxation. It worked. The chief regained the use of his hands and arms, and soon his leg and toes. "He seems highly delighted with his recovery," Lewis wrote on May 30th. "I began to entertain strong hope of his restoration by these sweats." The medical practice was critical to maintaining a continuing food supply, but by itself insufficient. The men needed more food than Clark's fees could provide. They had nothing in the way of trade goods, so it was down to the clothes off their backs, the buttons off their coats and pants. When the men discovered that brass buttons were an article of which these people are tolerably fond, the men cut off all their buttons to trade for roots. "Never ask your men to do something you won't do yourself," is time-honored advice to company commanders. In this case, the captains cut the buttons from their dress coats a few days later, which brought in 3 bushels of roots. "A successful voyage," Lewis said of the trading venture, "not much less pleasing to us than the return of a good cargo to an East India merchant." On May 21st, the captains took a drastic step. They decided that each man should make his own deal for roots sufficient to get him over the bitter roots. Each man got 1 awl, 1 knitting pin, 1/2 ounce of vermilion, 2 needles, a few skeins of thread, and about 1 yard of ribbon. Lewis called it a slender stock indeed with which to lay in a store of provision for that dreary wilderness. He comforted himself with the thought that they could fall back on horse meat. The expedition's herd was growing, thanks to Clark's doctoring, and by the beginning of June was up to 65 horses. The long wait with the Nez Perce gave Lewis an opportunity to do more ethnography. He described the tribe's dress and ornaments at some length. He judged the Nez Perce to be cheerful but not gay. Their young men were fond of gambling and games. So were Lewis's young men. In addition, Lewis had the problem of idle hands. Like most company commanders with that problem, he turned to athletics as a way to keep up morale and strength and reach out to the natives. The result was a tournament. There was a shooting match, which Lewis won with two hits of a mark at a distance of 220 yards, something even more impressive to the Indians than his air gun. On horseback, the Nez Perce put the American soldiers to shame. Lewis was amazed at how accurate they were with the arrow, even when firing at a rolling target from the back of a galloping horse. There were frequent horse races among the Indians or between Indians and whites. Lewis remarked, "Several of those horses would be thought fleet in the United States." The Indians could do feats that the whites could only watch. "It is astonishing," Lewis wrote, "to see these people ride down those steep hills, which they do at full speed." The stallions in the expedition's herd were so troublesome the captains offered to trade two of them for one of the Indians' geldings. The Indians refused. The captains decided they would have to take the risk of castration and began the operation. A young man interrupted to show the whites how the Indians did it. His method was to let the wound bleed rather than tying off the scrotum. As an experiment, the captains had him operate on two stallions in the Indian way, while Drouillard gelded two in the white way. 2 weeks later, Lewis wrote, "I have no hesitation in declaring my belief that the Indian method of gelding is preferable to that practiced by ourselves." Horse care, horse trading, horse racing brought the white and red men together. On the evening of May 13th, "We tried the speed of several of our horses in races against one another and Indians. It is an irresistible scene. The young braves, red and white, racing from point to point over that beautiful valley with the snow-topped mountains looming behind, whooping and whipping their horses, digging in their heels, while crowds of onlookers, also mounted and also a mix of red and white, cheered them on. Wherever one looked, there were horses, Appaloosas mostly, selectively bred, active, strong, and well-formed, according to Lewis. They were present in immense numbers, a phrase Lewis hadn't used to describe a herd of animals since he left the buffalo country. 50, 60, or 100 head is not unusual for an individual to possess. That herd was by far the Nez Perce's greatest asset. It also represented a potential solution to one of the major transportation problems facing the proposed American trading empire stretching from St. Louis to the mouth of the Columbia. The trick would be to get the Nez Perce herd over to the other side of the mountains, which in turn depended on making a peace between the Blackfeet and the Nez Perce, which was hardly likely as long as the Blackfeet had guns and the Nez Perce did not. Still, Lewis was resolved to try. As he gazed at the magnificent herd, he began to imagine two long strings of Indian pack horses passing each other on this prairie. One was headed east, carrying spices and other fabulous goods from the Indies. The other headed west, carrying furs from the Missouri River country and trade goods from Europe. In the image, Nez Perce horses would make up for the lack of an all-water route across the continent. It was an idea Lewis had started working on back at Fort Clatsop. His first attempts to begin creating the conditions that would make the plan workable had failed. He couldn't get a Nez Perce delegate to go with him to meet with the Blackfeet, or a chief to come to Washington with him. But he stayed with the idea and continued to try to think it through. There were frequent foot races. Lewis was impressed by one Indian who proved to be as fleet as the expedition's best runners, Drouillard and Reuben Field. There were games of prison base, an Indian game in which each side tries to make prisoners of those who run out of their base area, and pitching quoits, a white man's game of throwing flattened rings at a pin. Lewis encouraged the games, for they gave the men who were not hunters some badly needed exercise. "They have had so little to do that they are getting rather lazy and slothful." Mainly what they did was look at the Bitterroots to see how much snow was left. The expedition's energy was as tight as a coiled spring, ready to vault itself over those mountains in an agony of anticipation of being released. Waiting for snow to melt is rather like watching grass grow. The first discernible sign of progress is greeted with the greatest joy. Thus Lewis on May 17th. "I am pleased at finding the river rise so rapidly. It no doubt is attributable to the melting snows of the mountains." Still, they had to wait. The mountains remained. that icy barrier which separates me from my friends and country, from all which makes life esteemable. Patience, patience, Lewis advised himself as he concluded his journal entry and closed the elkskin-covered volume. Not until May 26 did he let a little optimism into his journal. The river still rising fast and snows of the mountains visibly diminish, he wrote. Ethnography and nature studies helped him get his mind off the snow. On May 27th, one of the men brought him a black woodpecker, which Lewis had already seen and noted but not held in his hand. He now gave it a 500-word description. The throat is of a fine crimson red, the belly and breast is a curious mixture of white and blood red, wings and tail are of a sooty black, top of the head black, with a glossy tint of green in a certain exposure, and so on. The bird is now named Lewis's woodpecker. Lewis preserved the skin, which ended up at Harvard University. It is his only surviving zoological specimen. On June 6th, we meet with a beautiful little bird, also described in charming detail. It was the western tanager. Lewis also collected, described, and preserved close to 50 new plants, including camas, yellow bells, Lewis's syringa, purple trillium, ragged robin, and Mariposa lily. Paul Cutright calls this his most productive period as a botanist. Every day, the Nez Perce told the captains they would have to wait. As May turned into June, the waiting got harder. Twisted Hair had told them that the tribe would cross the mountains in May, but that was before the winter snows began. It had snowed and snowed and snowed, far beyond an average year, to such an extent that some of the Indians were warning the captains they would have to wait until July. But on June 3rd, Lewis was surprised and pleased to learn that today the Indians dispatched an express over the mountains to Traveler's Rest. The express was a teenage boy who went seeking information from the Flatheads about the occurrences that have taken place on the east side of the mountains during the winter. If the Indians could send a boy over the Lolo Trail just to pick up some gossip, Lewis thought it probable that we could also pass. He told the Nez Perce he was going to try, but they replied that, although their boys could make the trip, Lewis's men could not. The creeks were too high, there was no grass, and the snow was deep over the roads, which were extremely slippery. They told Lewis to have patience. In 12 to 14 days, he could set out. On June 4th, Lewis met with some of the chiefs. He repeated his request for guides to accompany his party to the falls of the Missouri, then up to the Blackfoot country in search of a truce. The chief stalled. Lewis checked the men's packs and was pleased to find that our whole party have an ample store of bread and roots for our voyage. All around the campsite, the men were much engaged in preparing their saddles, arranging their loads, provisions, etc., for our departure. The captains planned to move camp eastward from the banks of the Clearwater to higher ground at the western terminus of the Lolo Trail on the southern end of Weipe Prairie, where they had first met the Nez Perce the preceding September. There they would make camp and begin the final preparations for the assault on the mountains. On June 8th, 2 days before the move, there was a sort of farewell party at the campsite they had occupied on the banks of the Clearwater for nearly a month. The afternoon featured horse and foot racing and game playing. In the evening, Crusot brought out the fiddle and dancing began. But as the festivities went on, an Indian told the captains that the snow was still deep and they would not be able to cross until the beginning of July. He warned that if they tried it sooner, the horses would be at least 3 days without food. "This information is disagreeable," Lewis admitted. "It causes some doubt as to the time at which it will be most proper for us to set out." But not enough doubt to deter the captains. Lewis explained, "As we have no time to lose, we will risk the chances and set out as early as the Indians generally think it practicable, or the middle of this month." By midday June 9th, everything was in readiness for the move to White Prairie. The mood was exuberant. "Our party seem much elated with the idea of moving on towards their friends and country," Lewis happily noted. "They all seem alert in their movements today." Notwithstanding the thoughts of what lay ahead, they were "amusing themselves very merrily today in running foot races, pitching quoits, prison base, etc." The expedition was about to resume its march. Chapter 28. The Lolo Trail, June 10th to July 2nd, 1806. On the morning of June 10th, just before the expedition set off for White Prairie, Cutnose sent word that two of his young men would overtake the party in a day or so, guide it through the mountains, then lead Lewis to the falls of the Missouri. Welcome news, the best possible. The party moved out in high spirits. Each man, and presumably Sacagawea, was mounted and leading a pack horse. In addition, there were several spare horses. "We therefore feel ourselves perfectly equipped for the mountains," Lewis wrote. He established camp at the Quamash Flats. Quamash was Camas, the route that had stood off starvation for the men in September, and then damn near killed them. Stomachs had adjusted. The men could eat it now without violent consequences. The plant was so central to the lives of the Nez Perce that Lewis wrote a 1,500-word description of Camas and the Indian methods of preparing it for food. His concluding sentence was, "This root is palatable, but disagrees with me in every shape I have ever used it." He enjoyed its appearance. "The Quamash is now in bloom, and from the color of its bloom at a short distance it resembles lakes of fine clear water. So complete is this deception that on first sight I could have sworn it was water." By June 13th, the pressure on the captains, from both within and without, to get going was all but irresistible. But Cutnose's young men had not shown up. Lewis gave them one more day. Meanwhile, he sent two hunters ahead to a prairie 8 miles east to lay in a stock of meat. The Indians did not show that day or the next, and Lewis gave up on the guides. On the evening of June 14th, he ordered the horses hobbled in anticipation of an early start. "From hence to Traveler's Rest," Lewis wrote that night, "we shall make a forced march." With the decision to go without guides, Lewis had allowed impatience to cloud his judgment. He was taking chances and violating Jefferson's orders to be always prudent so that he could carry out his number one objective to get to the Pacific and back with a report on the main features of the country. And for what was he taking such a risk? To get home a little earlier? If the expedition could get to Traveler's Rest by early August, and if it then took the Nez Perce route to the Buffalo Country, it would be at Great Falls by the middle of August. There it could dig up its caches and then speed downstream, with 2 good traveling months to get to St. Louis. But Lewis felt a pressing need to get going. Besides just giving in to impatience, he had some genuine objectives in mind, primarily further exploring. He and Clark had agreed to divide at Traveler's Rest. Clark would go to the Jefferson River and on to Three Forks, where he would cross to the Yellowstone Valley and proceed down the Yellowstone to the Missouri, mapping and describing new country every step of the way. Lewis would follow the Nez Perce Buffalo route to Great Falls, then conduct an exploration of the Marias River to its sources. He hoped that those sources would be well north of 49 degrees. That would be good news to bring to the president. To make these side explorations, the captains needed to get over the mountains by the beginning of July. That was why Lewis felt time pressing. But, although the expeditions to the Marias and the Yellowstone were interesting and important, they were not significant enough to merit risking everything. Lewis's usual good judgment had left him. Previously, he had made his decisions on the basis of what needed to be done next to make the expedition succeed, not what might be done in 2 months if such or so were done now. Previously, he had been a mature, responsible senior commander, except with the Sioux, where he had allowed himself to be provoked into taking excess risks. Now he was an impatient junior officer acting more on impulse than on judgment. He had always been self-confident. Now he was cocksure. He remarked at Limhi Pass in 1805 that anything Indians could do, he and his men could do. Even after seeing the Clatsops and Chinooks in their canoes, after seeing the Nez Perce ride their horses, he retained that notion of white superiority. Even when the Indian boy who set out to cross the mountains a couple of weeks earlier showed up to report that he had been forced back by the heavy snow, Lewis insisted on going. The Nez Perce told him it couldn't be done. At first he discounted them. Eventually he ignored them. He proposed to be the first to cross the Lolo Trail in 1806 and without guides. In his journal on June 14th, Lewis admitted to apprehension. The snow and the lack of grass for the horses, will prove a serious embarrassment to us, as at least 4 days' journey of our route in these mountains lies over heights and along a ledge of mountains never entirely destitute of snow. Clark wrote that evening, "Even now I shudder with the expectation with great difficulties in passing those mountains." Lewis rationalized the decision. "We have now been detained near 5 weeks in consequence of the snows," he wrote. "A serious loss of time at this delightful season for traveling." Whatever the risk and apprehension, there is no doubt the decision to move out was a popular one. "Everybody seems anxious to be in motion," Lewis wrote, "convinced that we have not now any time to delay, if the calculation is to reach the United States this season. This I am determined to accomplish, if within the compass of human power." On the morning of June 15th, in a cold, driving rain, the party set out. At 8 miles, they found 2 deer the hunters had killed and hung. At noon, they halted at a creek and dined while the horses grazed. Through the afternoon, they marched. The going was difficult because of fallen timber crisscrossing the trail and a slippery pathway caused by the rain. Still, they made 22 miles. Lewis did a bird count and found a hummingbird nest. So far, so good. No snow yet, so the trail was easy to follow. June 16th, an early start. The party ascended a ridge and nooned it at a handsome little glade where there was grass for the horses. The glade was bursting with life. Lewis noted the dog-tooth violet, the bluebells, the yellow flowering pea, and the columbine in bloom, and the honeysuckle, huckleberry, and white maple putting out their first leaves, along with other signs of spring in the mountains. But within a couple of hours of resuming the march, the party found itself in winter conditions. The snow was 8 to 10 feet deep. Fortunately, it was firm enough to bear the horses. Indeed, it improved the traveling, for it covered the fallen timber, but it also covered the trail. They made 15 miles during the day and camped at the small glade where Captain Clark had killed a horse the previous September and hung it for Lewis and his men. There was insufficient grass for the horses, and it was obvious that as they continued to gain altitude, there would be even less grass. In the morning, the going was difficult and dangerous. The climb toward the ridge was steep, the elevation gain dramatic. After 3 miles of climbing, "We found ourselves enveloped in snow from 12 to 15 feet deep, even on the south sides of the hills, with the fairest exposure to the sun." Lewis thought he had prepared himself for the worst, but he hadn't. "Here was winter with all its rigors," he wrote that evening. The party was 6 or 7 days' march from Traveler's Rest, provided it was fortunate enough not to lose the way, and of this, Driard, our principal dependent as a woodsman and guide, was entirely doubtful. In an analysis that would have been better written 5 days earlier, Lewis admitted, "If we proceeded and should get bewildered in these mountains, the certainty was that we should lose all our horses and consequently our baggage, instruments, perhaps our papers, and thus eminently risk the loss of the discoveries which we had already made if we should be so fortunate as to escape with life." He consulted with Clark. They reached an obvious conclusion. "We conceived it madness in this stage of the expedition to proceed without a guide." This led to a resolution. "To return with our horses while they were yet strong, to an encampment with sufficient grass. Driard and Private Shannon would hurry on back to the Nez Perce villages to hire a guide. The party would wait for them and subsist on hunting, preserving their roots." That resolution made, "We ordered the party to make a deposit for all the baggage which we had not immediate use for." In the deposit, the men put the roots they had brought, depending on the hunters for the next few days for food. In addition, Lewis put in the instruments and journals. The journals were by far the most precious of all the expedition's possessions. The reason Lewis left them in the deposit illuminates what a risk he had taken in starting too soon. He wrote that they are safer here than to risk them on horseback over the roads and creeks which we had passed. The deposit was laid on scaffolds and well covered. At 1 o'clock p.m., the party started down the mountain. Lewis hated to turn around. So did the men. "The party were a good deal dejected," Lewis wrote. This is the first time since we have been on this long tour that we have been compelled to retreat or make a retrograde march. Sergeant Gass added that most of the men were melancholy and disappointed. On June 18th, Driard and Shannon struck out for the village to procure a guide. The price Lewis was ready to pay for a guide was unprecedented. He gave Driard an army rifle to be offered as reward for leading the party to Traveler's Rest, and authorized him to promise 2 additional army rifles and 10 horses to any man who would lead the party to the falls of the Missouri. The next morning, the party made camp in a meadow on the edge of the mountains. There was plenty of grass. The horses could fatten up here while the men waited for a guide. One of the men found some black morel mushrooms, which Lewis roasted and ate without salt, pepper, or grease. In this way, I had for the first time the true taste of the morel, which is truly an insipid, tasteless food. On neither that day nor the next 2 was there any sign of Driard and Shannon. The captains worried about them and talked about what they would do if they couldn't get a guide. The plan they agreed on showed the depth of their desperation. "We have determined to risk a passage without a guide," Lewis wrote. "Captain C, or myself, shall take 4 of our most expert woodsmen, with 3 or 4 of our best horses, and proceed 2 days in advance, taking a plentiful supply of provision." The party would find the Lolo Trail by the marks on the sides of the pine trees, marks made over the decades by Indian horses and baggage rubbing against the trunks, and by tomahawks. At the end of the 2nd day, 2 men from the reconnaissance party would march back down the mountain to inform the main party whether to come right on or to give the scouts more time to locate the trail. If the trail could be found, Lewis was confident he could get through, because the snow was firm. So the horses got good footing without having to step over or around fallen timber every few yards. If the trail could not be found, Lewis proposed to move far to the south in search of an alternate route over the Bitterroots. On June 21st, the party fell back to the Quamash Flats, where the hunting was better. During the march, 2 young Indians, probably teenage boys, were encountered. They informed the captains that they were headed up the mountain to visit their friends on the other side. Lewis's eyes lit up at this news, but without Driard, he found it difficult to understand the flashing hands of the warriors. Apparently, the Indians were saying that Driard and Shannon would not be returning for 2 more days, but Lewis could not make out a reason for the delay. Lewis pressed the Indians to stay with his party until Driard and Shannon returned, and then to serve as guides for the crossing. They agreed to delay 2 days, no longer, at their own camp, closer to the mountains. 2 days later, still no sign of Driard and Shannon. Lewis was fearful that the 2 young Indians would set off that morning, so he sent 4 men to detain them, with Sergeant Gass in command. If the Indians insisted on going, Gass and his squad should accompany the Indians to Traveler's Rest, blazing the trees as they proceeded along the Lolo Trail. That afternoon, to the relief of all, Driard and Shannon returned. The delay had been caused by bargaining, but it was well worth the time. They had with them 3 guides. One was a brother of Cutnose, and the other 2 were men who had each given the captains a horse. Lewis described them as all young men of good character and much respected by their nation. He was overjoyed to have them, even at the price of 2 rifles. In the morning, the expedition was off at first light. The party made it back to the campsite of June 19th to 20th, where it met with Gass, his squad, and the 2 Indians. The grass was good. After dark, the Indian set some fir trees on fire, telling Lewis it was to bring fair weather for our journey. This made a spectacular sight. "They have a great number of dry limbs near their bodies," Lewis explained, "which when set on fire creates a very sudden and immense blaze from bottom to top. They are a beautiful object in this situation at night. This exhibition reminded me of a display of fireworks." They were off at 6 o'clock a.m. In mid-morning, they got to the deposit they had left 9 days earlier. Everything was in good order. The snow had subsided from 11 feet to 7. As some men rearranged baggage, others cooked a meal of boiled venison. The Indians urged haste. They said it was a considerable distance to the place they had to reach before dark, the only spot where there was grass for the horses. In 2 hours, everything was ready. "We set out," Lewis wrote, "with our guides who led us over and along the steep sides of tremendous mountains entirely covered with snow. We ascended and descended several lofty and steep heights. Late in the evening, much to the satisfaction of ourselves and the comfort of our horses, we arrived at the desired spot and encamped on the steep side of a mountain convenient to a good spring. Here we found an abundance of fine grass for our horses." They had reached the untimbered south side of Bald Mountain. The grass was 10 days old, lush and green. The next grass, according to the Indians, was a day and a half's march away. On June 27th, another early start. After 8 miles, the guides reached an elevated point where there was a conic mound of stones 8 feet high. The Indians stopped for a ceremonial smoke. "From this place, we had an extensive view of these stupendous mountains," Lewis wrote. The sight filled him with awe, dread, and an even greater respect for the Indian guides. "We were entirely surrounded by those mountains," he commented, "from which, to one unacquainted with them, it would have seemed impossible ever to have escaped. In short, without the assistance of our guides, I doubt much whether we who had once passed them could find our way to Traveler's Rest." The marked trees on which he had counted so heavily when he thought the party would have to go without guides turned out to be very few and far between. But he had confidence in the guides. "These fellows are most admirable pilots," he explained. Whenever the snow was melted away, the party found themselves on the trail. After smoking with the Indians and contemplating this scene sufficient to have damped the spirits of any except such hardy travelers as we have become, we continued our march. That day they made 28 miles and camped on the side of Spring Mountain. At Bald Mountain they had been at 6,000 feet. At Spring Mountain they were 500 feet higher. There was no grass for the horses, and the men had exhausted the meat supply. The captains distributed a pint of bear oil to go into each of the 4 kettles, there to be mixed with boiled roots. Lewis judged it an agreeable dish. In the morning, Lewis cast his eye over the herd and was disturbed to see the horses looking extremely gaunt. The guides reassured him. They would be at good grass by noon. Sure enough, after 13 miles at 11 o'clock a.m., we arrived at an untimbered side of a mountain with a southern aspect. Here we found an abundance of grass. As the horses grazed, Lewis asked the guides how far to the next grass. "Farther than the party could march in the afternoon," the Indians replied. "As our horses were very hungry and much fatigued," Lewis decided to make camp right there. In the morning, after a march of 5 miles took them to Rocky Point, the guides led the party down the mountain to the Loxa River, then up the trail to the Quamash Flats, today's Packer Meadows, a couple of miles south of Lolo Pass, on the divide between the Clearwater and the Bitterroot Rivers. They were at 5,200 feet, and there was plenty of grass. The horses grazed, and the men ate. There was still plenty of daylight left, so after dinner the party set off down the valley toward the Bitterroot River. At 7 miles, the men reached today's Lolo Hot Springs and went into camp. As soon as camp was set up, the men, red and white, plunged into the pools created by the Nez Perce over the decades by the use of rocks. The Indians would stay in the hot bath as long as they could stand it, then leap out and run to the creek, which was ice cold, and jump in, whooping and hollering and splashing. When they were too cold, they ran back to the hot bath. Lewis took a hot bath only. He stayed in 19 minutes. It was only with difficulty that he could remain that long. It caused a profuse sweat. On June 30th, the party marched down the valley. The men were well out of the snow, but the trail was often difficult, sometimes dangerous. At one steep hillside, Lewis's horse slipped, with both his hinder feet out of the road and fell. Lewis fell off backward and slid 40 feet before he could grab a branch to stop himself. "The horse was near falling on me as he slid," he wrote, "but fortunately recovers and we both escaped unhurt." Just before sunset, the party rode into Traveler's Rest. They had covered 156 miles in 6 days. The previous fall, the expedition had been slowed by old Toby's losing the way and by the fallen timber, and it had taken 11 days to cover the distance. On this crossing, the horses had grass every day but one. To Lewis's delight, they had stood the journey surprisingly well. Most of them were in fine order, and only want a few days' rest to restore them perfectly. This was thanks to the skill of the guides. Their sense of distance and timing, not to mention their sense of direction and ability to follow a trail buried under 10 feet of snow, was a superb feat of woodsmanship. Most of the trail was in dense forest, and the guides were young men, not yet 20 years of age. The expedition had been as lucky in its guides as Lewis had been in his fall from the horse, as Lewis knew. When he wrote that not even Driar could find his way in these mountains, he was giving his guides an extraordinary compliment. The party stayed at Traveler's Rest for 3 days. The captains put the final details into the plan for exploration they had been discussing through the winter at Fort Clatsop. In its final version, the plan went like this. Lewis, with 9 men and 17 horses, would follow the Nez Perce route to the Falls of the Missouri. At the falls, he would drop off 3 men to dig up the cache and prepare to help in a portage. With the remaining 6 volunteers, Lewis would ascend the Marias, with a view to explore the country and ascertain whether any branch of that river lies as far north as latitude 50. He also hoped to meet with the Blackfeet so that he could deliver his peace and trade speech. Those missions completed, he would go to the mouth of the Marias to meet the men coming down the Missouri. Those men would be led by Sergeant Ordway. He was to proceed with Captain Clark to the head of the Jefferson River, where the expedition had left its canoes before crossing Lemhi Pass with the Shoshones. Ordway and a party of 10 men would descend the Jefferson and the Missouri in the canoes. They would get help in the portage around the falls from the 3 men left there by Lewis. Once around the falls, the combined force of 14 would proceed to the mouth of the Marias, there to pick up Lewis and his party. Reunited, they would descend to the mouth of the Yellowstone, where they would meet Clark and his group. Clark's independent exploration would start at the Three Forks. After dispatching Sergeant Ordway's party, Clark and the remaining 10 men, and Sacagawea and her boy, would cross the divide between the Missouri and the Yellowstone. When they reached the river, they would build canoes. Clark and 5 of the men, plus Charbonneau and his family, plus York, would descend the Yellowstone in the canoes to its junction with the Missouri, where almost the entire expedition would come together again. Missing would be Sergeant Pryor and 2 privates. They were assigned an independent mission. When Clark set off in the canoes, they were to take the horses to the Mandan villages to use as gifts, with strings attached, for the Mandans. They had a second charge, to deliver a letter from Lewis to the Northwest Company agent Hugh Heaney, whether at the Mandans or, if necessary, at Heaney's post in Canada. It was a highly ambitious plan, exceedingly complex, full of promise about what could be learned, dependent on tight timing. It certainly showed how confident the captains were about their men. For the first time, they were dividing the party to pursue different missions. They were giving large responsibilities to sergeants and privates, counting on their men to be able to handle independent operations without a hitch. It was also an excessively dangerous plan. The captains were taking chances they should have avoided. In the heart of the country that the war parties of Crows, Blackfeet, Hidatsas, and other tribes passed through regularly, the captains were dividing their platoon into 5 squads, so widely separated they were not in supporting distance of one another. Lewis took the risk of dividing his command because he wanted the expedition to be as successful as possible, to bring back as much information as possible, to make every conceivable effort to broker peace among the tribes, to begin the process of creating the American trading empire. These were important objectives, but not important enough to justify having squads as small as 3 men, and none larger than 10, roving about independently. The captains were underestimating the Indians. They had perhaps spent too long with the easily dominated Clatsops and Chinooks, too long with the always friendly Nez Perce. Although they knew more about the native peoples west of the Mississippi River than any man alive, they had no direct knowledge of the Blackfeet. They did know that all the other Indians feared the Blackfeet. Lewis and Clark didn't know enough to fear the Blackfeet, nor did the men. Since Lewis was leading his squad to the heart of Blackfoot Country, his was the most dangerous mission. Nevertheless, when he called for volunteers on July 1st, many turned out, from whom I selected Driard, the two Fieldses, Werner, Fraser, and Sergeant Gass. That afternoon, Lewis wrote a 1,500-word letter to Heaney to be carried to him by Sergeant Pryor. It represented his first step toward bringing about an American trade empire stretching from St. Louis to the mouth of the Columbia. Lewis had met Heaney the previous winter and had been impressed by him, despite his being an agent for the Northwest Company. Heaney had told Lewis that if there was anything he could do for the Americans, he was ready to do it. Apparently, he talked as if he was ready to drop his Northwest Company connection and go to work for the Americans. Lewis must have thought so, for he made Heaney an offer to do just that. If Heaney could convince the influential chiefs of the Sioux to visit their new father in Washington and go along with them to serve as interpreter, Lewis would pay him $1 a day from the date of the receipt of the letter, plus expenses. Lewis further promised that Heaney would be first in line for the post of U.S. agent to the Sioux, which paid $75 per month plus 6 rations per day. Lewis was straightforward about his motives. He wanted the Sioux to have an ample view of our population and resources, and on their return convince their nations of the futility of an attempt to oppose the will of our government. Lewis provided Heaney with arguments to convince the Sioux to make the journey, the chief being that the Sioux had no means of resisting the American plans for building posts and fortifications along the Missouri, and in any case, their acquiescence will be productive of greater advantages than their most sanguine hopes could lead them to expect from opposition. Lewis stressed a central point for Heaney to pass on to the Sioux. The United States will not long suffer her citizens to be deprived of the free navigation of the Missouri by a few comparatively feeble bands of savages. But he should also tell the Sioux about the friendly views of the United States government toward them,